This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. When it comes to today's political landscape, there's not a lot of common ground. The right and the left are very far apart on some major issues. But when it comes to criminal justice reform, there are proposals that both sides can agree on. Many conservatives don't like paying taxes to support so many prisoners who locked up for so many years, and they aren't even violent. Liberals and progressives think the criminal system is institutionally unfair to the poor and people of color. Now, new policies are being passed into law in red and blue states to be less aggressive in locking up people and throwing away the key and finding ways to release prisoners who are not violent. So what about public safety in these issues and this concern? What about the rights of the victims? You might not think that breaking into cars to steal stereos is a nonviolent crime when it comes to you, because you certainly felt violated when that happened. Well, what do you think about criminal justice reform that looks to release nonviolent criminals from prisons and jails federally and at the state level? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You could also email your questions and comments to The Source at tpr.org and tweet us at tprsource. We're joined by Lauren Brooke Eisen. She's a senior counsel for the Brennan Center's Justice Program, author of many reports, most recent being How Many Americans Are Unnecessarily Incarcerated. Also with us is Professor Gerald Remy. He is a St. Mary's University School of Law professor and consultant and regular lecturer for law enforcement agencies and the criminal defense bar and the judiciary. And welcome to The Source, both of y'all. It's great to have you here.
That's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
And Lauren Brooke,
thank you for having us.
Let me ask you about the central question that you have. How many Americans are unnecessarily incarcerated? So how many?
So we issued a report in December of last year analyzing prisoners in both federal and state prisons to identify who could be released with very little to no risk to public safety. And we considered a variety of factors. We looked at seriousness of the crime, impact on the victim, intent, and the risk of recidivism. And we looked at how many people don't need to go to prison at all, and then how many people are there for too long. And our report found that about 39% of America's total prison population is unnecessarily behind bars.
Unnecessarily behind bars? They committed a crime. Don't they need to be punished?
So that's a great question, and our criminal justice system, as you're aware, is vast, and we have over 2.2 million people in our county jails, our state prisons, and our federal prisons, and a lot of those people don't need to be there at all. Specifically, we found that 25% of prisoners, those who are in state and federal prisons, almost all nonviolent lower-level offenders, would really be better served by alternatives to incarceration. And these are alternatives such as treatment, community service, probation. And those are people who, you know, could be their first charge, or they may suffer from a some sort of mental health diagnosis or drug addiction that could really be better treated in the community or with, you know, mental health providers or drug providers, drug treatment providers, as opposed to just sitting, you know, in a state or federal prison without getting this programming and treatment.
When we use the word nonviolent offenders a lot, what is a nonviolent offender? What falls under that umbrella?
So every state has different categories of what's considered a violent crime or a nonviolent crime. And, you know, depending on the jurisdiction you're in, a violent crime tends to be a crime where some sort of, force or a weapon has been used. Nonviolent crimes are typically those such as drug possession, theft, crimes that don't involve any sort of violence. But it gets tricky because, you know, a crime like burglary is considered a violent crime in some states, including New York, but you don't need to necessarily have committed any act of violence to be charged with a crime like burglary. And then there are additional crimes where, you may be, let's say, on the lookout, or you may be involved in the crime or an accomplice, but you didn't know violence was going to be committed, or you may not have committed violence yourself. So the law can be tricky.
If I commit one of these nonviolent crimes, like breaking into someone's house, but I'm carrying a gun on me at the time, is that a violent crime?
You could potentially be charged with a violent crime, yes. Specifically, what was the gun accessible? Could people see the gun? And so that's exactly one of the situations where you could be charged with a violent crime, even though the gun wasn't actually used in the crime itself.
All right. So Professor Remy over at St. Mary's University School of Law, you look at these issues quite a bit. And what do you consider a nonviolent crime?
I think Lauren Brooke has touched on a number of important points here. States tend to characterize crimes somewhat differently according to local prerogatives, and for that matter, so do local law enforcement agencies. We have uniform crime reports that are done through the Department of Justice, and with those, you typically would find drug possession perhaps leading the list of crimes that are considered to be nonviolent, although there are many others, common theft and so forth. She's quite right that burglary in some places is considered to be a violent crime, although statistically burglaries are usually not violent. That is, they don't pose any danger or threat. There's no assault. There's no injury, no harm to a person. Your typical professional burglar, if you will, would much prefer not to have a confrontation and tries to arrange things so that there is no confrontation with another person. So to characterize burglary as a violent crime in many respects is misleading. Almost any crime can be committed in a violent way. And even crimes that are clearly classified as violent and probably should be, like robbery, for instance, which is a theft by taking, that kind of crime can be done in a very non-injurious way. So we just have a problem right from the beginning when talking about violent crime. But if a crime, to go back to your question, if a crime is committed by a person who's carrying a weapon, in many states that automatically qualifies that offender for a very much higher jail sentence. And that goes to the question that the Brennan Center report is really addressing. Is it necessary to incarcerate that person on the basis that they carried a weapon at the time that they committed the crime when they haven't really done any violence?
So the key issue is public safety. Is trying to prevent someone from breaking into my house and stealing my stuff, is that an issue of public safety? Or are we just going to write that off like, well, he didn't hurt anybody, he didn't kill anybody, so therefore it's not a violent crime. But, you know, what about me? I worked really hard for that stuff, and this guy just came in and took it, so he doesn't have to. That doesn't seem right to me. So criminal diversion, we'll look at all these issues when we come back from the break. We're talking about nonviolent crime and putting people in jail. The United States has 2.2 million people in jails, prisons, and county lockups across the country, the highest incarceration rate in the world. What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What about the rights of the victims? And what about concerns for public safety? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. How do we reduce prison population without endangering public safety? That's the question this hour. The number to call in with your ideas and thoughts and issues and your own experience is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Let's bring another voice into our conversation. This is Derek Cohen. He's the Deputy Director for Right on Crime and the Texas Public Policy Foundation Center for Effective Justice. And Derek, so you're a conservative, and you bring in this idea that conservatives have joined that we got too many people in prison. Is that right?
That is correct. You know, you saw that that general proposition take hold back in 2005 and 2007 when we were topped out at about 160,000 prison beds under the watch of the state. It was getting to a breaking point financially, and we just weren't able to sustain the current sentencing practices that we had. So we took a very scrutinous look the Texas legislature did at how people were getting into prison, whether it was through original offending or revocation. And we implemented some policies that made sense, you know, that speak to some of the phenomena that are discussed in this report. That really allowed the judges and prosecutors to have more tools in the toolbox instead of just weaker tools.
Let's take some callers. We've got so many callers already online. The number is 210-614-8980. But, Derek, I got a lot of questions for you, so hang on for that, too. Jen has called in. Jen, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, David. I have a question for your guests. I'm wondering, I know that they discussed alternative programs to prison, like drug treatment programs, therapy, that type of stuff. How does that type of program affect recidivism versus prison time for nonviolent offenders? And then also, honestly, I'd be a little curious to see how it affects violent offenders as well.
Okay, Jen, thank you for that great question. So, Lauren Brooke?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of evidence over the last 20 years or so that drug treatment programs and other programming that really gets at the driver of why someone may commit a crime in the first place is, in most situations, much more effective than spending time behind bars. And that's because you're actually treating why someone may commit crime. You know, are they committing crimes because they suffer from a drug problem and they are, selling drugs to, be able to ensure that they have money to buy more drugs, right? This sort of cyclical effect of just being arrested and incarcerated and arrested and incarcerated with, very little reentry support is not making us safer and is not going to reduce recidivism of the people who are being arrested and convicted of committing these crimes. And in our report, How Many Americans Are Unnecessarily Incarcerated, we do detail a lot of research studies that indicate that they're much more effective at reducing recidivism and improving outcomes for the people who cycle in and out of the criminal justice system than spending years behind bars.
So, Derek, can you talk a little bit about reduction of recidivism and also keeping in mind public safety?
Certainly, and that's a very good point. Now, conversely, completely abolishing prisons of all sorts and just offering drug treatment is not, and that's not to say that the authors are suggesting that, clearly not. That would not be a panacea either. One particular approach that we took in Texas, though, was we actually spent $241 million in 2007 on building up treatment beds. Were they at intermediate sanction facilities, supporting our state jail facilities, whatever the case may be, we actually increased capacity in these alternative sanctions while we were able to actually close prisons shortly thereafter. We closed, I believe, four prisons here in Texas, and there's talk here during this current legislative session to close a fifth.
All right, but reducing recidivism, that means stopping the cycle of people going back to jail over and over again. They commit a crime, they get caught, they go to jail, they get released, they have no other choices, so they go back to the life of crime. So, Professor sure. Remy, can you talk about, what is a proven way to break that cycle?
Well, I think some of these programs have proven to be a very effective way to break the cycle. They're not the only ones. Every case is different. Every offender has different needs. We won't be able, as Derek says, to get rid of the prisons entirely by simply providing treatments for prisoners. Through the history of the United States criminal justice system, you can actually see the cycles where we have, at some periods in our history, turned more to the rehabilitation model. And then in other cycles, we're purely involved in retribution, punishment for its own sake. At the moment, there seems to be, largely fueled by the kind of financial concerns we're talking about, a turn toward more serious treatments than we've had, but which ones will depend on the kind of offender that we're dealing with. So drug treatment's one, alcohol abuse, mental illnesses, a major part, and then there are other factors that we haven't touched on.
Like economic or education?
Economic, education, age, frankly, is a huge thing. We've got prisons that have substantial populations of prisoners who are now in their mid-50s and older. The statistics show us that those people are very unlikely to reoffend, and it doesn't make much sense for the state to continue to pay to keep them in a bed when they're not likely to pose any safety risk.
Okay, another caller, John. Hey, John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. And my comment is they got Al Capone on tax evasion. So how many of this large chunk of people who are in, quote, just for possession are in on that possession charge because they got a plea deal to avoid sentencing for other charges that might be out there that necessarily wouldn't be part of their sentencing because they were never actually tried or part of the deal that was in on it? And how does that affect the calculus?
Okay, John, great question. So let me ask you that, Derek.
Well, I can't speak for this particular report. The idea that we've heard floated, you know, whenever it comes time to readdress sentencing and we have to start discussing about the in-facility populations, is the idea of that, you know, these people might have taken pleas. And the problem is you can't address that in any serious way because we only have, at best, you know, record of the charging instrument and then what the actual plea was. Now, in my experience, what I tend to see is that you don't see this radical downward departure from what the facts of the case would suggest. But that's not to say that it does not necessarily reflect or at least kind of gloss over partially, some bad behavior when these plea deals go through. The reaction to that, though, at least what we've seen in the last couple decades, has been, okay, well, if the facts are X, Y, and Z, statutorily we're going to prohibit plea deals. They've done that in Detroit. They've done that in Boston. And what we see is you generally find then the actual charging document, the facts of the case is presented before a grand jury or a petit jury, tend to be altered then. So it doesn't take any discretion out of the system, but discretion still manages to get away around that.
Right, so we see things like Lauren Brooke. Is this what happens? Someone tries to run somebody over with a car, and then they are they're charged with assault with the vehicle, and then they go to the court, and then they plead down to reckless endangerment, and so they don't actually get that violent offender label on their record, and you count them as a nonviolent offender. Is that what happens?
So I'm a former prosecutor myself, and if a prosecutor doesn't have evidence to bring a case to trial and doesn't think that the elements are there to convict someone of committing a crime, ethically they can't bring that case to trial. Right? You need to have the elements of the crime there, whether you're looking at a plea deal, whether you're looking at a jury trial, bench trial. So if the specific situation that you just described, were a real situation, then that prosecutor would probably plea down because they're just, the elements of the crime, or there could be some other circumstances such as the victim, may not have wanted to go forward, that crime just couldn't, that charge couldn't go forward with those elements. The caller mentioned this sort of Al Capone idea, this theory that, Al Capone committed all of these crimes, but, was sentenced to prison for tax evasion. Those situations are, that's more of an outlier. What the criminal justice system is, mostly dealing with is people cycling in and out of the system. Most of the people behind bars are not there for tax evasion. And, the reason that we wrote this report is because our prisons are filled with so many people who just don't need to be there in the first place. And, we acknowledge that, there are certain crimes, there are certain situations where a prison sanction may be the best situation for that specific crime and that specific context. But even for those who commit more, violent, serious crimes, our report acknowledges that those people may be there for far too long. There's a good deal of research, and most recently the Brookings Institute, ourselves at the Brennan Center have been researching how long people spend behind bars, and there's a lot of really great evidence out there that indicates that the longer people spend behind bars, even for more serious crimes, the less public safety value we're getting for those dollars.
Okay, another caller, Jonathan. Jonathan, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello, yeah. Hello, yes, thank you. I just had a quick question. How exactly does the private prison playing into the nonviolent convictions, because I do know that Texas has taken a step with getting rid of private prisons for federal, I believe. But how does that play if they still have, you know, a foot in the race as far as getting prisoners into their prison, their jail cells, you know, to get paid by per bed? And how exactly do I help? How can I help to contribute to progressively go forward with this, you know, nonviolent criminals being, you know, criminalized and being in prison instead of rehabilitation or some type of other methods? Because as we know, if you release people without a good education that have been to prison, you know, the cycle does continue, or without rehabilitation, you're just making better criminals. And thank you.
All right, Jonathan, thank you for that call. Derek Cohen over at the Right on Crime, what's happening with private prisons on this?
Well, I have to partially reject the premise that the existence of private prisons is what's causing this. I mean, conservatives see private prisons as neither here nor there in the discussion of effectiveness of incarceration. I mentioned the four prisons that we've closed in Texas, three of which have been private facilities. If you look at the actual business model for your GOs, your CCMs, you see this radical pivot from, you know, their previous, you know, build them up quickly and keep them stocked business model to now one that is definitely offering, or definitely oriented towards offering, more effective rehabilitation. And you're even seeing some of the contracts that certain states are entering to with these private prison providers, entering into contracts that have more check and balances on the recidivism outcomes, basically offering for contract termination if the outcomes are not better than what we're actually seeing in the public prison. So I see the issue of private prisons as a bit of a non sequitur. But if that is something that motivates somebody to reevaluate sentencing policy, all the more reason to take an open look more at expanding, like I said, expanding the toolbox.
Well, there are private prisons and they are publicly traded companies, as you mentioned, and so we can look at their stock prices to see. And they've been on the decline until recently, since the election of President Donald Trump. America's private prisons have seen their stocks just go skyrocketing. Core Civic, also known as Corrections Core of America, and Geo Group have, their stock prices have doubled since the election. Core Civic is up 140% since November. So they're looking at that they're going to be full again because of some of the rhetoric we're hearing from President Trump and also from Attorney General Sessions. Derek,
I need to push back on that just a little. That was also the Obama administration promised a full divestiture of private prisons, which I think would have a far more greater impact on the bottom line. So I think this was a negative effect, and by that I mean effect in negative space, if any.
So they were looking at a sunset of their ability to operate, and that looked bad for them, depressed their stock prices. But now it looks like they're going to continue, so that depressing news was taken away, so their stock jumped back up to where you think it's appropriate. Is that what you're saying?
No. Again, I'm not making any value judgment on private prisons. You know, conservatives and libertarians look at that and just see that as a privatization of services the government's already providing. When you talk about how that affects sentencing policy, well, that's a completely separate argument.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more about that when we come back from this break. We'll continue talking about public safety and putting and reducing the criminal population in our prisons. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about how conservatives and progressives are coming together on one central idea about reducing the prison population without endangering public safety, looking at nonviolent criminals who are locked up for long stretches. These nonviolent criminals could be drug offenders or people who just committed crimes without harming others, and whether or not they should be released and how that should be done in a very effective way. The phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment, call in 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Lauren Brooke Eisen over at the Brennan Center's Justice Program, author of the report, How Many Americans Are Unnecessarily Incarcerated. I know that you have looked deeply at the private prisons. We were talking about that before we went to break. And what is your take on the influence of private prisons? I know that they work closely with ALEC in crafting legislation to incarcerate more people.
Yeah, so I am looking into this issue, and I am writing a book on the influence of the private prison industry on mass incarceration, and the prison population in private prisons has grown 70% from 69,000 prisoners in 1999 to 126,000 prisoners in 2015, and that's while the overall prison population has grown only 10%. So they have certainly expanded, and you know the two biggest private prison corporations, CCA, or it's now CoreCivic, and Geo Group, which are both publicly traded on the stock exchange, earned a combined $4 billion last year in 2016. But you know what Derek was saying about their influence is, you know, it's an interesting question because you know that there are areas in the country where the private prison industry, you know, may be influential on, you know, certain pieces of legislation. But when we look at the whole picture of mass incarceration, it becomes very complicated. And this idea of ensuring that the contracts, when states and the federal government contract with private prison corporations to run and operate prisons, it's really important moving forward that we structure those contracts around reducing recidivism and improving outcomes for the people who spend their times in those facilities. And that's something that just hasn't been done traditionally in this country, and it's something that we're seeing other countries like Australia and the UK start to do. And so it's this idea of really ensuring that we work with the private prison industry to increase programming and reduce recidivism and, you know, improve education in those facilities. And, you know, perhaps, you know, the state and federal governments are not really very good at reducing recidivism. That's why we have a recidivism rate in this country that's over 50%. You know, about half the people who enter our state and federal institutions are, you know, behind bars within 3 years again. So this is something that we as a country really need to improve upon.
So public policy in regards to incarcerating people is largely set by public opinion. It's not just facts and figures. I know you have some interesting facts at the Brennan Center. The violent crime rate has gone down 26% in the last 10 years. You would not know that by listening to some of the rhetoric coming out of the President of the United States, Donald Trump, where he says America is in crisis, talks about out-of-control homicides that we have across America, and we're at a historic low level. So there seems to be some sort of campaign out there that has reached the highest levels of our government, trying to tell Americans that we are living in a time of carnage and chaos and destruction, and that we need to get back to basics in regards to locking up criminals and throwing away the key. And so I know that you were at CPAC. You've been at the last five CPACs, Derek Cohen, over at Right on Crime and the Texas Public Policy Foundation Center for Effective Justice. What are you hearing? Are conservatives buying into this line coming from President Trump saying that we have this age of carnage upon us, or are we they want to go into a more conservative way of dealing with the overpopulation of prisons?
I think you have two unique issues there. You do have this, you know, for the first time in probably about three decades, this reprioritization or this refocus, or let's say two decades since Clinton, this refocus on, you know, violent offending. But again, you know, if you actually search those comments for what policy would be put behind it, there simply hasn't been anything forwarded. What has been forwarded is, you know, a more, I would say, a cooperative federalism approach to state and local law enforcement. Now, that's, you know, that could actually drive some. You know, there is such a thing as over enforcement, but that doesn't mean that it per se drives mass incarceration, as some would deem it. So I really don't think that there is this, you know, this campaign to lock up more folks yet. I think we do have some cases where we do have some shoring up to do of the federal criminal code. But you also have to keep in mind, and this is one of the themes at CPAC, and also one of the themes of President Trump, is that there is this real pro-federalism push now. So I think that you're going to see, if anything, I guess the footprint of federal criminal justice enforcement, you know, actual crimes enforced by the by federal agencies. I think you're going to see that start to wane, especially when we start looking at regulatory offenses. But even with the violent offenses, I think that if there is to be an increased enforcement, at most, it'll just be through cooperative federalism.
So, Lauren Brook Eisen, are you concerned that tough talk on crime coming from Attorney General Jeff Sessions and President Donald Trump is going to go against the current that you have been surfing so far of trying to release nonviolent criminals?
We are concerned at the Brennan Center. President Trump and now Attorney General Sessions have described an America that's just not reflected in the America that most people see in their own neighborhoods. In his inaugural address, he spoke about American carnage. Attorney General Sessions and President Trump have been, stating over and over that, crime is on the rise and, constantly talking about drugs flooding across the border and an increase in violence. And, a lot of this is rhetoric. We in the United States are safer than we have been in decades. Nationally, crime rates remain at the bottom of a 25-year downtrend, half of what it was at its peak in 1991. And last year, rates of overall crime fell for the 14th year in a row. Now, it's true that homicides increased in some cities in 2016, but those are, the homicide increase is really mostly driven by a few outliers, such as Chicago. And it is worrisome because we have been living in this bipartisan movement towards criminal justice reform, and we are, we have four decades of research indicating that alternatives to incarceration and other ways of dealing with those who may violate the criminal code are much more cost effective and much better at reducing recidivism than prison. And so this is worrisome, because a lot of this is rhetoric and because we know what we know about prisons, right? We know today that longer prison sentences do not reduce recidivism rates. We know that so many Americans are not getting the treatment and the services that they need in prison. Most prisons have very long wait lists for programming, if they even have adequate programming in the prisons. And so that's worrisome to us.
And so back to Attorney General Sessions and his record in the Senate as the senator from Alabama, received basically a D- from the Brennan Center for his votes on trying to deal with overpopulation of crimes and dealing with nonviolent criminal offenders. He did co-sponsor legislation to reduce sentencing disparities between powder and crack cocaine, but also he opposed last year bipartisan criminal justice overhaul efforts and warned that eliminating or reducing mandatory minimum sentences weakens the ability of law enforcement to protect the public. So, Derek, it seems like the number one criminal, the lawman on the beat in the United States, the Attorney General Sessions, is not going to be receptive to many of these ideas.
Well, the only state of play that would alter is the 8% of all prisoners nationwide that are held in federal facilities. Criminal justice is still wholly a state phenomenon. And if you look at the progress made in states like Texas, Alabama, Oklahoma, and conservative states that are starting the process, like Louisiana, you generally see that, I would say, conservative policymakers, especially the ones closer to the problem, have been generally disabused of such rhetoric.
Okay, another caller, Juan, is on the line. And hi, Juan. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm not a politician. I'm not a private citizen, but I'm also a taxpayer. And I'm tired of people spending my money on things that don't work. I understand people need to commit crimes and they need to be held accountable. But throwing more money into the prison system and now into the private system. It is only getting some people rich, and all that money is going to waste, in my opinion.
All right, Juan, thank you very much. So Juan is calling as a taxpayer, and, you know, as a conservative, Derek, the taxpayer is pretty high as people that you're trying to take care of, right?
Exactly. I think Juan hit the nail right on the head. If you look at what really opened the minds of Texas legislators back in 2005 and 2007, it was that initial encounter that Speaker Craddock had with the then chairman of the Corrections Committee, Jerry Madden. You know, and after a full decade under the governorships of Ann Richards and George W. Bush, you know, Madden was told, look, you can't build any more prisons. They just cost too much. He basically was given a carte blanche to come to the speaker with just about any alternative. Working with Senator John Whitmire of the Senate Criminal Justice Committee, you know, they actually crafted a very robust, very thorough piece of legislation. Now, since it was the first bite at the apple, there were some rough edges on it, right. And it eventually got vetoed by Governor Perry. But they tried a similar approach and a more thorough piece of legislation in 2007.
Okay.
And Perry signed that.
All right, Derek, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back. We're going to continue our conversation. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Reducing the prison population without endangering public safety. This is an issue that progressives and conservatives are finding common ground on, and we're talking about that this afternoon here on The Source. Let me turn to our professor at St. Mary's University School of Law, Gerald Remy, and let me ask you about the role that the defense attorneys, public defenders especially, can play in keeping nonviolent criminals out of jail. If they get a better lawyer, maybe they won't end up in prison to begin with.
Well, I'm a big fan of good lawyering. I don't care whether it's appointed lawyers or somebody who's been retained by a criminally accused person. I certainly think that lawyers can play an important role, both defense lawyers and prosecutors, in helping the court to arrive at an appropriate sentence in cases where people are found guilty. And sometimes that doesn't happen. The more information we have, the more the sentencing authority, usually the judge, knows about the case and about the person, the more we're able to investigate, the more we're able to provide details about the crime and the way in which it was done, about the criminal history of the defendant who's before the court. All of these things are important in trying to arrive at an appropriate way to handle this person. One thing we have to keep in mind, and we haven't mentioned it today, although we talk about it frequently when we discuss issues of incarceration, is the people that we put in prisons are coming out. They're not staying there forever. There are very few people who get actual life in prison. And so we need as a society to prepare not just for getting them into prison and then thinking about, well, are they going to come out at some point and how's that going to work? They are going to come out. And what we can control as a society is when they come out, are they better prepared to avoid the things that contributed to their offending in the first place? If we can do that, then I think we have a chance at succeeding with permanent reductions.
First, to have better public defenders, we need to fund better public defenders.
Absolutely. The money that's being spent now in the state of Texas and virtually every state around the country, in my opinion, borders on the scandalous. It is so low that, unfortunately, it drives a lot of lawyers toward not doing the kind of work that they should be doing, and I think that's a terrible problem. So ethically, of course, a lawyer is obliged to provide good representation regardless of how much money you get paid. The reality is, if you don't have enough money to pay the rent on your own office, you're going to have to cut some corners someplace, and that, unfortunately, is what some lawyers do.
You talk about when prisoners get out of prison and they get into the real world and they're confronted with the reality which they can't reenter. And some people have talked about banning the box. Derek Cohen over at Right on Crime, where are you on banning the box?
We're actually very supportive of Ban the Box initiatives for public sector employment and for companies that wish to take it upon themselves.
Can you describe it really quickly what that means, banning the box?
Certainly. That means either not asking or delaying asking about an offender's criminal history, oftentimes felony involvement, adjudicated felonies. And, you know, there have been a lot of proposals and, you know, I think some before the state right now that mandate both state and local entities are going to do that. But similarly, there's also ones that preempt localities from forcing private sector from doing that as well. And right on crime, you know, our general philosophy on this is, you know, painting with a broad brush, just like we talk in sentencing, is a fool's errand. And so, too, is it trying to prescribe hiring policy for those who might be justice involved. So, you know, we're generally supportive of the public sector and companies that can fit it within their hiring protocol. But we don't support the compulsory ban the box policy for private employers.
But you see that by delaying asking people if they have committed a crime, then we're wasting so much human that we can give people a chance maybe to get a job if they show that they are capable and that they have paid their debt to society. We have invested as a society in educating many of these people. We're losing all this capital, making more people taxpayers is a good thing. Is that where you're coming from?
No, and we definitely recognize that. The problem is, if you look at the literature around compulsory ban the box, and it's mixed, to be honest.
Well, compulsory, but just as a concept of giving people a chance.
Well, certainly. But I mean, unfortunately, I mean, that concept has to met itself out in reality. And that's where I think alternatives such as, again, if you want to applaud and pat on the back private sector employers that do, but also you should be looking at indemnifying employers, indemnifying landlords, you know, make the civil burden that the civil exposure that these people might have for facilitating better outcomes for these folks. Get those off the table. Okay. So, I mean, there's a million alternatives out there, and I think that looking just towards the criminal history question is a bit short-sighted.
Okay, we're going to get to some of these calls in just a second, but Professor, you wanted to jump in.
Yes, let me interject here that another way to do this, of course, is to change the laws related to expunction of criminal histories. I volunteer to represent veterans and provide some free legal service for our military veterans. And one of the most common questions I get from veterans is about expunction of something, some criminal history record that goes back to 20 or 25 years ago, and it's preventing them from getting licensure to pursue a trade or going to law enforcement,
right.
Exactly. Any number of things. And the laws in the state of Texas are so restrictive on expunction of criminal history that it's virtually impossible to find a client who qualifies for expunction. We should change those laws.
Okay, callers. Fred? Hey, Fred. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, I'd like to open by saying I'm a 61-year-old middle-class boomer. I'm also a convicted felon. I was arrested for pot in the 1970s, just like a whole bunch of friends of mine were, and they all still have felonies records. Until we truly reform marijuana laws, issue these young folks a ticket or something. Just don't give them a felony for it. Goodness, it's ridiculous. Don't throw them in jail with possibly violent criminals. I was pretty fortunate in that I had a loving and forgiving family and friends and even employers who knew I was in out of control phase, if you will. Many others weren't as fortunate. When I got locked up, you know, they had, back in the 70s, they had this three strikes and you're out rule. And I met a man, a good man, who was had a prison, a life sentence handed to him for stealing one box, a small box. He was a homeless man, but he got imprisoned for a life term for stealing a box of beef tongues. He was homeless and he was just stealing stuff, but he got thrown in jail for the rest of his life for that. I know other people my age whose names now adorn downtown and north side buildings who got off scot-free because they could afford a great lawyer. And there are lots of people who can't afford lawyers.
right, Fred, thank you so much. Good points. Lauren Brooke Eisen.
I think those are excellent points, and there are a huge swath of Americans are in prison for crimes where they would just be much better sentenced to other alternatives. And, you know, that's really the crux of this report, is looking at at proportionality, and I think that's what this caller was really getting at. You know, our criminal justice system has, you know, especially the way we sentence, we've moved very far from proportional sentences. Our report indicates that length of stays have dramatically increased in both the state and federal prison system over the last two decades, and Americans aren't committing more crimes. You know, we're not more violent. In fact, we're much safer than we were. And additionally, a lot of states have reduced crime and incarceration at the same time. And so I think, you know, that supports this notion that we just don't need to be doing what we've been doing for so long.
And that shows us, the story from Fred shows us the cost that all this. Another caller, Tamer. Tamer, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'm an attorney here in San Antonio, where your show is produced. And, you know, there's some things that I see that happen with clients that I represent and that I think really raise the cost of operating our local jails here. For instance, here in Bexar County, a lot of times warrants will be issued for individuals for minor traffic violations if they didn't go to court to handle it, or for low-level misdemeanors or a low-level felony, and those warrants will be issued in secret maybe months or even years after the actual offense, and the person is never told about it. And so what happens is the police at some point, 6 months or a year or so later, end up picking up the person for the warrant and take them to jail. Well, there's a lot of money involved in issuing a warrant and having police officers spend their time to go pick someone up and then process them in and out of our jails. And sometimes they process them in and they're out in 24 hours, but that's a serious cost for our jail system. And sometimes they have to stay for days until they get bonded out, when really, you know, they could really just send, most of the time, these are very low-level offenses, they could simply send a postcard to the person and say, hey, listen, if you don't come in within 7 days and do a walkthrough, which costs practically nothing for the city, we are going to send police officers to get you. And I think we're wasting a lot of money on processing really low-level people in and out of our jails.
Okay, Tamer, thank you so much. You bring up some great points there. Too many callers. I couldn't get to all of them this afternoon. This is a hot issue. We're going to get to some of the finer points in later shows. We will talk about over-criminalization. We'll talk about bail reform. Lots of issues here that need to be tackled. Clearly, there is an appetite to talk about this with our listeners. I want to thank all of our guests, Lauren Brooke Eisen over at the Brennan Center, Derek Cohen over at Right on Crime at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and Professor Gerald Remy at St. Mary's University School of Law. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.